You've got the click click pen as well. It makes me very nervous. You know those like Uber tabloid gotcha style interviews where they've got like for some reason they have flashcards. Like, why do they have flashcards? I don't know. But and then they just get you. They're like, so you said this in 2012.
Yeah,
I'll be curious to inspect your sheet afterwards to see how you interview.
Yeah, but, like this is, I'm not proud of this.
This isn't my finest hour.
No, it's definitely not. I'm not that prepped, but I was reassured by some of the prep that I did do, in that you, in theory, should be extremely easy to interview.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, and dude, I got the email from the Producers Club. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah.
No, legend. More. Class. Good. Really class.
No, I've been meaning to do it for a while.
Hero.
Not much.
You'll get a shout out now.
Oh yeah.
You can shout yourself out. Hey, and just want to thank our new sponsors.
Are we taping?
We are. I can turn it off.
Are we taping? That sounds like this is probably a reference before your time, but Ash's famous album 19 something.
I didn't put you down for an Ash fan.
Yeah, back in the day everyone was an Ash fan.
Bro.
Yeah.
I gotta interview them. They're on the list.
Yeah, yeah, that'd definitely be cool. But they do, they're like back in the days of CDs, which again might be before your time.
No, I even had a tape cassette.
Oh really?
Vintage collection.
Whatever happened to mini discs?
Okay, I don't know what that is.
Yeah, I tried that for a while. I think I felt like I was a bit of a pioneer. And then no one else joined in.
Mate, so you could have been suckered into Korean radio if you had kept that nonsense
mini
up.
Discs. Back in the day, I'm trying to think of any other examples to back this up, but I think some bands would have put like a secret track at the end of their last song.
Ooh.
If you pressed and held skip, then it would like fast forward, and like you wait in the Ash album, you wait for like 15 minutes, 30 minutes or something.
Oh my goodness.
And then it gets to this recording of them. They're obviously pissed and they're like mucking about and making each other sick and all. And they're like, are we taping? And it sounds so posh. It's like very North Down kind of banger.
So good.
Yeah, posh accents.
Mate, that's a class Easter egg there. I never would have known that little piece of analog technology.
Oh, yeah.
Sneaky.
Yeah.
You're like, the digital world ruins a lot of that stuff because you're like, yeah, I'm going to put like a secret question at the end of this podcast and like everyone can see like 40 minutes remaining and you're
Yeah, so Ash were ahead of their time, I think.
How do you think I would get Ash?
You're bound to have an angle.
I don't know. I mean, I've interviewed the Snow Patrol drummer. I don't know if he would even know them. Don't know.
He would. He definitely would. Northern Ireland is a small place. I know Best of Belfast is pushing Belfast. Sam, we're pushing boundaries. Some amazing people, but it's still a small place and everybody knows everyone.
Super small.
Exactly. Yeah,
super small.
Episode 101.
This is it.
Yeah. The dream's coming true.
Yeah, we brought you back.
Yeah. And did you always plan then someone else would interview that you for episode 101?
No, not at all. I was obviously trying to get Liam for 100. That was like the big thing. It was a big part of the story of the podcast. Like, yeah, guys, like we're going to interview Liam Neeson for episode 100. Like, whoa, like we can do this. And then whenever he got back and he says, you know, lad, thanks very much, but I'm not going to do any interviews. And I was like, yeah, okay, fair play.
Yeah.
And I started like brainstorming, like scheming and thinking like, what are we going to do? Like, who are we going to get? And I always was like, it would be kind of weird to get like someone else for 100.
Uh-huh.
But like everyone would know that it's not Liam Neeson. So you know what I mean? Like,
you mentioned it a few times, have you?
I mentioned it loads. Like maybe even in like episode 0, like I said it.
Yeah.
So it's like a long, long time.
Good for you, because you must have thought it was always a long shot, but you still put it out there.
100%.
You know, that's very humble of you to say, I want to get Liam Neeson. I want to get Liam Neeson.
Yeah.
Knowing like Liam Neeson's Liam Neeson.
He
right?
is, yeah.
Yeah. Knowing that plan B is Trimble interviewing me. So
yeah, you're the backup plan pretty much. We're both the backup plan.
what a fall from grace. Liam Neeson to me.
100%.
Yeah.
And then to be fair, like as well, I always thought I would maybe stop at 100.
Uh-huh.
And so now that I am going to keep on going, I thought, like, here would be a good time to recap on, like, the journey so far and think about what's next and talk about what's next and kind of... Because 100's crazy. Like, I never expected... whenever I started it, obviously, to get 100.
Yeah.
There was a moment where later on I, like, made a firm commitment. It's like, I'm going to do 100 of these. And I think even that's part and parcel where, like, the Liam Neeson thing came from, because I have a tendency to, like, start loads of things and get super hyped about it and then, like, get bored and move on to something else.
Yeah.
So I was like, for flip's sake, Matthew, like, for once, let's just, like, make a long, steady commitment to, like, a creative project and just see where it goes.
Yeah.
So the 100 and the Liam Neeson was kind of almost like a, it was like a lock-in technique as well. Do you know what I mean? And I'm so glad that I did, because I probably would have curtailed off at, like, I don't know, like, the 30s were rough. Do you know what I mean? Like, in and around, like, episode 30s.
So 30s is probably, like, when the initial enthusiasm maybe wanes slightly.
100.
But you haven't got the momentum of, like, a 50s or a 60s.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the honeymoon period of your relationship has died off. You're now in, like, the... You're back at home. You're, like, have to empty the dishwasher. It's like, it's raining. It's like, oh, am I sure I've made the right decision?
I don't even like her.
But it's also, I think, my first 20. And this is a bit of a broad brush, but... I was able to interview, like, a lot of people who I already knew about and who I had a relatively close connection to. Like, they were relatively easy to interview. Now, there was a couple of kind of punts that luckily came through. But see, once I got to, like, 30, I was like, there's no one else to interview. I have no one else that I know. And I have no other connections, and I have no way. I was like, how, like, never mind, like, getting, like, 70 more of these. How am I going to get the next five? I was, like, in a serious famine, and I was, like, freaking out. I was like, this can't go on. Like, who am I going to get for next week? Like, there's a couple of, like, kind of freak out moments of, like, getting the guests.
So instead of proving how amazing Belfast is, potentially you might have proved how limited your options are in Belfast.
Hi, guys. We're here today with my mom. But I realized that... Well, part of it was that I needed to, like, kind of grow a set of balls and not be afraid to reach for a couple of people who I thought were out of my reach in terms of getting them on the show.
Give us an example of one of them.
I mean, like, one of the early ones was Michael Dean. Like, it was one of the interviews that I think really gave me a lot of courage and helped me really see, oh, my word, like, you could interview nearly anyone you wanted to. And I went into that interview, like, as a super newbie interviewer, like, definitely. Like, I would say, like, and I'm obviously still at the beginning of the whole interviewing career, but, like, definitely my first 30, like, I was totally, totally, totally just making it up. Uh-huh. But I interviewed him quite early on, and, like, it's a class interview. Like, he brought the goods. Uh-huh. Like, he just delivered, and he was so open and so, so charismatic and so amazing. And I was like, oh, my word, actually, my job's not that hard.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I just have to, like, ask a couple of open questions and just stay quiet, and it seems to work pretty well.
Yeah.
So I think after that, I was like, and that there was quite a good reach on that episode as well, and, like, a lot of people knew he's like one of the perfect guests, because lots of people know roughly who he is, and they know, okay, Dean's Restaurants, yeah, but most people don't have a clue about him. And I love that, because it's like the beauty of a podcast, and what I try to do at Best of Belfast is, well, let's give you the opportunity to get to know the people in your country.
Uh-huh.
And so someone with high profile, but not a lot of a, like, story out there in the public.
No, that's true. That's where I would fall as well. I would know of him. I would know, obviously, his restaurants, know he's a big deal, but I wouldn't know much about him at all.
Yeah, and he came out with crazy things. He was like, yeah, like, whenever I was, like, a young chef, like, I moved to London and I, like, slept on the streets a couple of nights. You're like, what? Like, you know, you wouldn't expect it, because we all have these kind of preconceived ideas and notions of people.
Yeah.
And I love the opportunity to kind of sit down and really figure out, okay, well, let's actually hear from you.
Yeah. So that one then, so whenever you're looking back, find that exercise interesting, because you look back and then I would imagine there's a lot of that. You're looking at the content, the type of people you're meeting and stuff, and learning something from that. But probably you're doing it as an exercise to see, right, what sort of stuff was I saying? Did I stick to a model? What was my plan? Mm-hmm. Like, or basically, was it good? Am I getting better at this?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're clever with how you interpret how you're interviewing someone, you can always be the good guy. If it doesn't go well, it's because they were boring.
Totally. Yeah.
And if it goes well, I am so good at getting this amazing content out of people. Did you look back and think, I can't believe I asked that question, or I'm rambling here, or was there any?
Oh, like all the time. Like we were joking kind of before we hit the mics, but it's like there's so many different styles of interviewing. I definitely haven't tried them all. Like there's that like stereotypical, like real, like ruthless journalist style that just like goes in for the jugular like all the time. Like that's totally not my style. Like I suppose I try to stay away from controversy in the pod, and I'm all about trying to like make people look good and like celebrate them. So that in itself saves me from like a lot of kind of like gotcha sort of moments. Mm-hmm. But I think looking back on, especially like I said, like the first 10, first 20, I definitely stuck too tightly to the script.
Uh-huh.
So I would go in with 12 questions and I would ask 12 questions.
Uh-huh.
And that would be it. And that's all I knew, so that's what I did. And also, I had this really weird thing where, like, it probably took me until episode 30 to actually talk the way I normally talk. I don't know if you found this with, like, doing stuff on audio, but, like, I listened back and I was like, what kind of a phone voice was I putting on for, like, 30 episodes? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the hardest part was actually just trying as much as possible to make it, like, a normal conversation. As if, like, pretend there's no microphone and you're sitting down with whoever it is. Can I have, like, a normal human interaction?
Uh-huh.
That was really, really hard. I don't know why. Maybe it's, like, we've been brought up with, like, the kind of radio, like, DJ sort of culture where it's, like, you know, I remember, like, listening to, like, Hugo Duncan and stuff. And he's got, like, when I was, like, going to school. And he's got, like, such a personality. And he's got all his wee quirks and stuff. And that's amazing. But it's, like, oh, you mean I don't have to do all that sort of stuff? Like, I can just, like, talk the way I normally do? It's, like, uh-huh. Okay, cool.
Yeah, I suppose maybe that's the difference between radio and podcast.
Mm.
Podcast is slightly more of an intimate feeling, isn't it?
Totally.
Listen, I'm very, very new to this, to podcast, and that podcast voice is interesting. But even just the whole atmosphere or tone, you find it kind of really gradually, don't you?
Mm.
And it's nice to get the most normal tone possible.
Yeah.
But it's actually really difficult to get.
So hard. Yeah, I don't know why. It's like, yeah, I know I've grown a lot as well, like in terms of like confidence and skill since starting the podcast. Skill, I've grown in skill. Wow. But I listened back to those first 10 episodes and I like don't even really recognize who's talking, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like it's that kind of night and day difference. And
tell me more about writing down 12 questions and asking 12 questions rather than having a conversation. Is that something there was a moment you kind of felt like you got more skillful at it, or you became, I suppose, not to use a little bit of an overused expression, but you were in the moment, you were experiencing the conversation.
I was experiencing
and going
Kairos.
Now we're talking. I walked right into that.
You did. It was a trap.
But so actually listening to what the person's saying and reacting to that, like a normal conversation, that sounds like the most obvious thing ever, but it's actually really difficult to do whenever you're thinking, right, if this drops off a cliff, yeah. I need to have something to say.
Yeah. I think what's really helped was confidence. And a big part of that was actually technical confidence, like confidence in my equipment. Like, because I started, I had like a £30 USB microphone. It was like a Blue Yeti Snowball, I think it was called. And like, I had this huge, huge, like, Lenovo laptop, like a gaming laptop, like, colossally big, like, and it was, like, such a clunky setup. And, like, my first few episodes, my very first episode I did in the woman's house.
Uh-huh.
And I met her, I DM'd her through Instagram, and I'd shared, like, her story on a photo on Insta. And then I was like, look, I'm starting a podcast, like, are you up for it? Oh, no, that's not true. We met for coffee. And I actually, this was before the podcast, and I like took my phone out and I was like, do you mind if I record this? Because I was going to write a blog about her.
Mm-hmm.
So met her in the National randomly, and she brought her husband because I think she was like, who knows who this guy is? You know what I mean? I need some security here. And so did like a really casual interview, went home and was typing up her story in the blog. And I was listening, I had my headphones in, I was listening back to the recording that I made, and I was like, oh my word, like I really like the way Lynn said this, I really like the way Lynn said that. And it just kind of dawned on me, it's like, why am I doing all this work to write a story myself,
mm-hmm.
whenever actually the technology exists for her to tell her own story and mm-hmm. me just to be like a platform or a vehicle to do that.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of like this. And I loved podcasts. Like, I've always loved podcasts. I'm an audiovisual learner, you know? And so audio has always been like something that I'm a big fan of audio. And I was like, why the heck? Like, why did I not do this? And I looked around and I was like, you know, I love Tim Ferriss. I was like, why is there not like a Northern Irish version of this? And at the time there wasn't. And I really simply, I was like, okay, well then I got to do this. So that was one
interview, and then you decided to change, to pivot and go a different direction?
Yeah, completely. Because at that point I was like going to go for like a Humans of New York vibe, where it's like photo, text, like kind of like a bit more spontaneous sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And then it was really listening to her story on my phone that I was like, mate, I want to start a podcast. So I well and truly, like, people say this all the time, but I really did walk in blind to it all. Like, I had no idea what I was doing.
Yeah.
And like the setup was so clunky, and I was like recording through Audacity, and it was just like a nightmare. And like, I was like panicking every second that like it was going to crash or something. Do you know what I mean? So I couldn't be in the moment. You know?
You couldn't be in Kairos.
I couldn't have that Kairos. Partially because I was so like anxious about my gear. Is the sound level right? You know, it was one microphone between two people. You're freaking out about the echo in the room. And then there was just like the kind of interview confidence. Like, I'd never really interviewed before. I've always been very curious, and I definitely have always been someone who asks a lot of questions. Like, it is a cliche, but like anytime like we were growing up and we were at parties, like I always would be the guy like in the kitchen, like standing beside all the drink and just asking people questions. Do you know what I mean? Like, I was always curious, like, why do people do what they do? Blah, 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 blah. But I'd never done it mic'd up. And that's back to what we were talking about, like the phone voice or the podcast voice.
Yeah.
It was being comfortable with myself and being comfortable in my own skin, or like in my own, I don't know, audio levels to have a real conversation with somebody. So that was what I think... That's where the area of growth has come. It's mainly just been confidence.
Yeah. That touching on that point of the tech, the confidence in the tech and the confidence in yourself, there was a guy called Richie Sadler. He played for the Republic of Ireland football. Now he does interviews for Second Captain's podcast.
Oh, nice.
And he interviewed Mick McCarthy, did the full interview, I don't know, 40 minutes or whatever, less, half an hour, whatever. And it didn't record. And he had to call him up and he said, oh, listen, Mick, that didn't work. Can we set it up again? Mick very generously decided, you know, offered to do it again. Did it again. Forgot to record it again.
No. That is like, I'm actually glad I didn't interview Liam Neeson, because I've had nightmares that happens.
Oh my goodness. That would break your heart, wouldn't it?
I would cry.
Yeah.
Then what happened third time?
You know what? You got him the third time and he recorded it correctly.
Jeez,
you know what? You could just say, actually, we actually did record Liam Neeson for the 100th episode, but it didn't record. So hard luck,
the
listeners.
File got corrupted. Can't believe it. Best conversation ever. Liam Neeson spills all. You'll never hear about it.
Yeah. The vision came true. You made it happen. Right. Listen, let's get all the way back. I want to get back to, I was saying to you before that there's been interviews where I've had to search for information and like trawl and just try and think of some ways to make this creative or interesting or entertaining. And you, in theory, should be the easiest person I've ever had to interview.
In theory, yeah.
Because there's so much going on. So as a 16-year-old, you were flogging t-shirts from your mum's garage. Then you planned to be a social worker. You moved to work with Tear Fund in Rwanda. Then you ended up in New York, helping out with homeless people and gang members. Then you returned home and you became a gardener. You became a delivery rider.
Shout out to all the guys riding right now.
Yeah, yeah, all your homies. Delivery bros. Then you became an author, podcaster, and a copywriter. You're like Forrest Gump.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, like Belfast's very, very own Forrest Gump.
I'll take it.
So what I did was there, so I said 16-year-old flogging t-shirts from your mum's garage. A non-Belfast way to describe that would have been you were an entrepreneur at 16 and you started a t-shirt company.
Yes, exactly. The American version is, I established my first company while I was still studying.
Yes, exactly. And I think that is maybe a little bit of an issue that you're trying to address with Best of Belfast.
Totally.
So that was my initial thought, go to that. And I don't mean to slag it off. I'm not slagging it off.
Oh, no, hit me, dude.
Like, but that's what we do.
Totally.
We slag ourselves and we slag each other.
Yeah.
But that aside, we can touch on that when we come back to Belfast, mm-hmm. Best of Belfast. I know what you're trying to accomplish there. But tell me about, as a 16-year-old, starting your own t-shirt company.
Yeah, so I was massive, like, English literature nerd. Like, that's what I loved. That was my thing. Unfortunately, it was not rugby. I played for the C team, which was, messy.
Could be worse.
Could be worse. Could play for the Ds. No offense. And so didn't really have any hobbies. I mean, like, I like video games and stuff, but didn't really have any idea what career path I was going to have. I mean, who does know they're 16? All I knew was I love English literature. So I thought, okay, well, I like English. I have to be an English teacher. That was kind of it. It's like, yeah, either I have to write the next Harry Potter or I have to become an English teacher. This is pretty much my two options. So Young Enterprise, they came to our school, and the choice was, like, do you want to do games or do you want to do this thing called Young Enterprise? And I was like, yep. What's Young Enterprise? Oh, who cares? I'll do it anyway. And so they gave us all the opportunity to start a business. And there's a guy I went to school with, his name is Xander, and we sat beside each other in IT. And just like 2 weeks before that, we had been like just like seeing what it would take to start a t-shirt company, because I think we had like a couple of like old vintage memes that we were passing around, like before memes was probably even a word.
Uh-huh.
And we were like, oh, these are so funny, like, ah, like we should get these on a t-shirt. Like, and I love t-shirts, like, I was always wearing like stupid like slogans and we like punny English stupid stuff, yeah.
Nerdy stuff.
Nerdy stuff, you know, just nerd stuff, guys. And so Young Enterprise came along and I was like, perfect. Like, this is the moment where these t-shirts can become a reality. So we set up this company called Quirk Tees. Fantastic name, excellent name.
And sign me up.
Yeah. We basically, the t-shirts that I had like scribbled down, they were our first five. And we found a way to print them. I grew up in Lisburn. There's a street in Lisburn called Longstone. And I like went to like this, you know, like those kind of like almost forgotten embroidery, dry cleaner, like get your zip fixed sort of places.
T-shirt City in Portrush.
Not quite, but like a wee like mom and pop. Oh damn, my Americanism just slipped in. Just this random wee shop, and he had this thing called a heat press. And so we like struck him a deal. We're like, mate, like, can we come in and use your heat press? We'll give you like a quid for every t-shirt we print. And he was like, yeah, sure, no worries. So he took us in, he trained us how to use it. When I say trained us, it's like a very it's a fancy way of like ironing something onto your t-shirt, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And so we started the t-shirt company. I put them on eBay, and we ended up selling like 5,000 to like 35 different countries.
Really?
Yeah. And they were like, I don't know, you probably get sued for them now, but it was like all like kind of playing on pop culture stuff. So it was like Harry Otter and like a wee like animal otter with like glasses and a wand and like all that.
Pretty good, yeah.
We had like a whole range of them. It was like Ron Weasel, like all that.
Uh-huh.
You get the gist. Like this is sort of the flavor we're talking about.
Was it exclusively Harry Potter puns?
No, not necessarily. It was like 80% Harry Potter. And we entered it. Young Enterprise has like a series of competitions, and so we entered in the competitions, and so like we won our county, and then we won our region, and then we won our county, and then we won all Northern Ireland, and then we went to compete in London. So just like in a very short space of time, we were like, oh my goodness, this is absolutely unbelievable. So, you know, we were like, you know, you're like 16 at the time. You just think it's the absolute gangster to like have a paid trip to go to London. You're like, whoa.
Yeah.
And really during that time, like a couple of things happened to me. I realized, oh, you can make money like not getting the job. Like I remember I worked in Frankie's and Benny's at the time. Shout out. Got $4.50 an hour as a busser. And I remember like, you know, we were making maybe like, I don't know, maybe like £5 a t-shirt or something. And it would take me like 30 seconds to make a t-shirt. I just remember having my mind blown because I would be in mum's garage, like printing a t-shirt. And every time I would lift it up, I would just be like, there's 1 hour working in Frankie's and Benny's. And I would do another one. I was like, there's 1 hour working in Frankie's and Benny's.
Yeah.
And that forever ruined me because I was like, oh my word, like I don't have to do something like that.
Yeah.
And it also, I mean, Young Enterprise were great. They like equipped me with a lot of the tools and the like insight you need of how to start a business. But again, it comes back to that idea of confidence. because in the same way, the technical side of a podcast is actually very easy. Like, it's easy when you know how, and once you know how, it's simple, but it's really just the confidence to go and do it. So I think they give me, and they continue to give, like, young people in Northern Ireland the confidence they need just to give it a go.
Yeah.
And I gave it a go and I loved it. And it's funny because it wasn't my first, like, entrepreneurial venture. Like, I did stupid things. Like, I think whenever I was like 11, like Eurospar or Spar or somewhere had like a really big deal on potato, cheese and onion crisps. I just bought piles and piles and I put them on eBay and I sold potato crisps to like people living in Australia, like Northern Irish people. Like,
oh, very good, yeah.
With like a ridiculous markup. And I don't know what way the crisps came at the very end. Like, they must have been absolutely disintegrated, yeah. But like, people kept buying them. And so I did like a couple of wee things like that. And in the t-shirts brought my love of words and wordplay. And I suppose I wouldn't have called it this back then, but sort of marketing and like spreading ideas and building things. And it just kind of tied like a lot of the things in my life together. So
how did you market the t-shirts then? How did people find out about them? Or did it just so happen people were searching for?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it was, you couldn't do it now, but you know, this was what, how old am I, 25? So, you know, eight, nine years ago, like there wasn't a lot of people selling real niche t-shirts like 8, 9 years ago. Uh-huh. So you kind of were lucky, like if anyone was searching Harry Potter t-shirt, like you would just come up.
Yeah.
Or like if, like, we, again, this is massive plagiarism, but very niche. But have you ever seen, if you say yes, I'll be very pleased. There was this YouTube video that Ed Sheeran did like 10 years ago with Example. And it was like down this back alleyway. I think it was like out the back of like some random Nando's in England.
Uh-huh.
Right. So they were on tour together when Example was like killing it.
Uh-huh.
And they did this freestyle and it was called the Nando's song. And they do this like off the dome, bro, all about Nando's. And it's just such a funny song. Like, I remember it kind of went viral. And there's just lyric in that song. And I just put it on a t-shirt. And I swear, like, don't tell Ed, but like I must have sold about 200 of them.
No way, really?
Yeah. So a part of it was like organic. A lot of it was organic, just people searching on eBay. And then we did have a website. We did lots of marketing ourselves. Like, we played into like a lot of the local stuff. So I think we made like 800 t-shirts for the Lyric Theatre. We did like their summer program t-shirts.
Yeah.
We did something for Downtown Radio, I remember. We, for the Schools Cup final, we like made like fanboy t-shirts for like all the players. So like the Weir brothers went to my school, so Peter Weir and Andy Weir, and we had this big like picture of like Andy Weir's head and underneath it like Fear the Weir and like all this sort of stuff. Who's the other guy? There's a guy called Gary Chan. It was like Chan's your man and like a picture of him, like all that kind of sort of stuff. So it was a combination of all those sort of things. And yeah, great crack.
So the Harry Potter stuff and the Ed Sheeran stuff, that's obviously stuff that just you were a fan of or you were interested in.
Yeah.
So it just coincided that, you know, there's probably a market for this out there. Now you're 25. Is it like you can never do that sort of thing? You have to kind of get something that suits your demographic or something you're going to understand or you're going to nail. Do you know what I mean? Like, was it just happened to be people who had the same taste as you just wanted these t-shirts?
Totally. And I mean, like, once you get like, so for example, most people would like discover us from like Harry Potter, and then they click on and there's like 30 other t-shirts. And if you think, like, if you're the kind of person that not only thinks a Harry Potter pun is funny, but also you're prepared to buy it and wear it, you're a specific type of person.
Yes, yeah.
So it's pretty high chance that you're going to like some of our other random stuff. Do you know what I mean? So
yes, yeah.
I haven't actually thought about it that way before, but I suppose like the barrier to entry is kind of niche and high already. So anyone who does come through the door, they're more likely to stay.
Absolutely. So you're not going to buy your Harry Potter t-shirt. And then you'd be searching and you'd be, people who bought Harry Potter also bought Ron Weasel, and you're going to go, that's just not funny.
Yeah.
That person doesn't exist.
That is so stupid.
Yeah. So what about then outside of Young Enterprise, what about your family and stuff? Your mom, was she sort of going, this is great, he's interested in this, he's starting another business? Or was she going, just stick to your English literature, get to college? Do you know what I mean?
My family were very supportive of me, and they were, they always kind of pushed me to do well academically. I had zero interest in academia. Like, it just wasn't for me. I think my mom was obviously incredibly supportive, especially by like letting me keep like thousands of t-shirts in the house, like in the garage, and like print there. My granny is someone who has always, like, I think my granny's taught me everything I know about money, and she is certainly not, she wouldn't call herself an entrepreneur, but she is very entrepreneurial. Like, she's very savvy and she's really got her head switched on. And I think she taught me a lot of like ways to see opportunities and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
All of my family come from a long line of employment. So my dad works for the railway and mom is a social worker.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are kind of like, those are jobs. They're like career jobs. They're job jobs.
Yeah.
And so they weren't necessarily, I don't even think they had it in their heads like, oh, like this guy could be an entrepreneur, because that's not, like you said earlier, that's not in the Northern Irish vocabulary.
Yeah.
It's not even in the Northern Irish mindset. Yeah. So I think that they were,
I actually find that word quite hard to pronounce as
entrepreneur. I think, you know, it was expected that I was going to do my A-levels and go to university. And while they were supportive, they also were like, mate, you need to knuckle down and get it done.
Yeah.
But the t-shirts took over my life for like 2 years. There's no doubt about it. Like, yeah. I fell into this black hole of t-shirts.
Yeah.
It took me a long time to come out of it.
That's fun though.
Super fun.
It's fun.
Yeah.
Just my young fella, you know, if he started doing something like that, if he stuck to something and threw himself into something,
yeah.
I would like to think, no matter what it was, I think every parent probably would prefer their child got a job.
Yes, of course.
I think just because it seems safer, it's just slightly more conservative. Just get a job.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I actually remember, like, so we must have been on, like, I don't know, Cool FM or U105 or something after we won. And Rory Best reached out.
Uh-huh.
He heard us on the radio. And he was
really?
Like, guys, really love what you're doing. Like, want to support you. And
he was trying to get a slice.
Yeah, he wanted that seed investment round, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he was like, look, yeah. So we were like, Rory, we'll make you anything you want. And so we like made a t-shirt for like him and his kid. And he put the photo up on social media. And like it went, we got loads of stuff from that. The Apprentice was really big. We like sent loads of stuff. We had like Alan Sugar t-shirts we sent to all the Apprentice winners. And like they like did loads of stuff for us online as
really?
Well.
Wow.
Sorry, I just remembered that.
Yeah. No, great. Great stuff. So you said your mom was a social worker.
Yeah.
And that's, you were going to go down that route at one stage then?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've got my my savviness from my granny. I've got my people skills and my, it's a bit of I don't know how else to say this other than like the compassionate side from my mom. So she's mm-hmm. always been really, really big on serving other people and taking care of, I suppose, people who the wider culture might find it more difficult to interact with and take care of. And I like, so like some pivotal things that like she encouraged me to do, like remember from a young age, like I want to say like maybe 14 or 15, like she just encouraged me to volunteer. And so like I ended up volunteering with Learning Disability. I did that for like 4 years maybe. And that was just like something I did on like a Monday night. But even that, like the amount that I look back on my life now, the amount that I learned from that experience of how to communicate with people.
Mm-hmm.
How to communicate with people who can't speak sometimes, how to stay calm and like lovingly interact with someone, maybe whenever they're having a bit of a freak out
mm-hmm.
or there's a bit of a nothing, you know, because I think a lot of reasons why people struggle to interact with someone who's learned disabilities because they just don't know how to do it. There's their sense of awkwardness, so they feel like they should be doing something. And kind of back to what we were saying about the podcasting, a lot of it is just learning to be normal. Like just learning just to sit casually and calmly and just be there and just interact normally the way you would with anyone else.
Yeah.
And that was key for me to learn. So yeah, mom definitely kind of like threw coals on the fire in terms of my love for people.
Yeah. Okay. So that I think maybe what I'm getting is that desire to help people and care for people and help, you know, be kind and be generous with your time, that was always there. And for a period of time, that looked like it was going to manifest itself in a career in social work.
Yeah.
And then you kind of changed your mind. Did you change your mind or did that just get superseded by you traveling and having different experiences?
No. So actually it was the social work sort of drive that pushed me away.
Okay.
So, I mean, I did have offers to university to study social work, but I just didn't feel like it was the right time. I also said uni's not for me. Like, I couldn't wait to get out of education. I was like, why on earth would I go back and do more?
Yeah.
And
did you move away straight away after school?
I left at 18, yeah.
Okay, like as in the summer, just after you finished?
Yeah, left in the summer, yeah.
So,
yeah, because I got my results when I was in Rwanda.
Uh-huh.
So I must have been swift.
Okay, yeah. So you were keen not only to get out of education,
yeah,
but you're keen to get out of Northern Ireland as well.
Time. Yeah.
So my experience, my final year at school, I could not wait to get out of away from home.
Yeah.
And then I ended up getting on unbelievably well with my mum and dad. Then the first year I left school, yeah, I was only an hour down the road, but just seeing them less,
we're
best mates.
Yeah.
And it's not like we didn't get on well, but you know, sure, it was just a wee bit distance and we were good mates. But I was itching to get out of Korean. Like, but was that something similar you experienced then? You just, was it education or was it getting out of Belfast or was it both?
Okay, it was kind of like, I don't know, 3 things, 4 things, 5 things, 10 things. It was just everything. Like, I wasn't a fan of Northern Ireland. Like, I definitely hated Northern Ireland. I thought there was, like, it was a crap place to live, like, no opportunities, blah, 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 blah. Like, wanted to go out and see the world and, like, go to somewhere that's actually good. Like, you know, all that kind of cliche.
Uh-huh.
Like, was very sick as a child and, like, spent, like, years of my life kind of bedridden. So I always kind of had in my, like, younger years, like, someday I'm going to go and see the world,
uh-huh,
you know, to make up for lost time, or, you know, to, if I ever, you know, get healthy again, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. And I was the guy that had like a bucket list whenever I was like 15, like, you know,
yeah.
And so I had the opportunity to go. And so I did, I just went. So, and instead of doing social work studying, I was like, you don't need a degree to help people. I'm just going to go and flip and help people, like, just right now.
What were you sick with?
I had chronic fatigue syndrome,
uh-huh,
and Lancer fever and all this kind of random, pretty normal stuff. But I just had like a heavier dose of it.
Uh-huh.
And
how long were you better?
I had like a lot of mental health stuff spur out of that as well. So like was really depressed and had like bad anxiety and stuff. So I got it. I was completely healthy until I was about 11. And then just after my 11 plus, maybe this is why I don't like academia, not what you mean,
uh-huh,
took sick. And then I was in bed for about 6 months. In my last year, P7, and then that time is whenever I picked up a lot of the physical and mental complications of that,
uh-huh,
that then kind of followed me like for the next 3-4 years.
Okay, so those difficulties, maybe growing up, a period of those difficulties, did that make you feel like you wanted to go and help someone then as a result of the experience you'd had?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always been a very, very sensitive person. Like, I always have been very keenly aware of the pain of other people. And I think also that combined with my own experience of real difficulty at a really young age has given me, I don't know, maybe you'd say like a sense of empathy for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, like, I was suicidal and stuff like during those times. Like, it was really difficult. And I think as well, it gave me a new appreciation of life and also how difficult life can be for other people. And I knew how dark things can get. And I suppose then whenever I came out the other side of that, I felt almost like I had an obligation to help other people, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of get through that, or, you know, assist them in their journey in whatever way I could.
Yeah, even if it's not the same as yours.
Totally. Like, it wouldn't have to be in the mental health space. It could be in any kind of...
Yeah.
Playing field, but yeah, that I always kind of had that drive.
Yeah, okay, right. So tell us about Rwanda and then potentially by contrast your time in New York.
Yeah, so that was crazy. This switch was crazy, but Rwanda was awesome. I would say, like, when I went to Rwanda, like, the 3 months I spent there were at that time the best 3 months of my life. And it's funny, like, looking back, I should have thought about this sort of stuff more so I could have given you some concise answers, but the Rwanda for me was just absolute freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'd never felt more healthy in my life. And like, you're outside in the sun like 10 hours a day, you're like eating really, really good food.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we were doing a lot of physical labor, And like, I just felt unbelievable, like really unbelievable. Like, was in my element, like meeting new people, learning a new language, like being like living kind of like in the community. So like being a part of the local community and like visiting the villages and like just I get on very well in that style of life, like to the point where I actually nearly cancelled my trip to New York and was just going to stay in Rwanda full time.
Uh-huh.
Because I was like, I love this. Like, I love being away from technology. I love not having access to the internet. I love kind of living like a hermit. I love the simplicity of life. I love the really close, deep sense of community I have in this place. And I was like, I'm just never going to leave. Like, I'm just going to stay here forever.
Uh-huh.
And it was a really, really difficult for me to leave. And I remember talking to an amazing leader, my kind of like manager when I was over there, is a guy called Rob Ross, legend. And I remember like, and he grew up in Zimbabwe, and so like he gets it, and we're kind of kindred spirits. Like, he's totally like, yeah, I just want to do this too. But I remember like going for a walk with him, and I was like, you know, I'm just going to cancel New York, like whatever. And he was like, well, is that what you're really supposed to do, or is that just what you want to do? Like, are you choosing Rwanda because it's easy? Or are you choosing it because actually this is where you're supposed to be? And I was raging with him. I was so angry at him. I was like, how dare you say that?
Yeah, what a dick.
Oh my goodness, I can't believe that. And then really thought about it, and I was like, damn it, he's right. Like, by me staying in Rwanda, I'm actually kind of running away, if that makes any sense. And so I was like, okay, like I'm going to see out my 3 months here, and then I'm going to move on like I said I would.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a position for me waiting in New York with this nonprofit called the Dream Center. And I was locked in there for 10 months. And I was really, really sad to leave Rwanda. But I did. And so went from Rwanda, a village called Ramagana in Rwanda, to Manhattan. And the culture shock was insane. Like, sure. Absolutely sure. Insane. It was bananas.
Yeah. So then whenever you arrived in New York, then was there a difficult transition, missing Rwanda and missing all the experiences there, and then the contrast of arriving? Then how did you kind of find your feet? Just throw yourself into it?
Yeah, I think like I was really sick my first 2 weeks. Like, everyone joked, it was like a run joke that I had malaria, which is not. But like, I even remember like that. Like, we did like this like ice breaking day, and it was like we did like a treasure hunt around the city. And I swear, like, I feel like I faded in and out of consciousness like during that trip. Like, we went to like parts of the city that like and there's photos of me, and I'm like, I don't remember that photo being taken. Like, I was really sick.
And did you know anyone there?
I didn't know anybody. The great thing was that it was also, I kind of feel like, it's a bit of a weird thing to say, but I feel like I brought like elements of Rwanda with me. So I had like a crappy phone, you know, so I had like, I didn't have a smartphone, I had a dumb phone, so I kept that.
A dumb phone, yeah.
We should start a business, dumb phone. And then
get Rory to invest.
Yeah, Rory, do you hear us on this podcast? Please call us. I know you're out of rugby, like you're looking for a new venture. But there was a real strong community there as well, because it was a group of us. We were all interns, and there was like, I think, 6 interns, and we were like living with each other full time, working full time. So I think because I had that community, the transition wasn't as hard as it could have been. But then also, frankly, New York is such a beast of a place.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean that like, oh, it's Beezer, mate. I mean, like, it's unlike anywhere else I've ever been. And that big city, you may as well feel like you're in the wilderness. You know what I mean? It's so volatile and exciting, and there's so much to see, so much to explore, that I think the kind of the adrenaline of it all kept me going as well.
Okay, yeah.
I think it would have been more difficult for me to go to like rural America, or like move back to Northern Ireland and go to university at that stage.
Yes, gotcha. Yeah.
Even though the you know, because, and I remember like sitting in Times Square journaling and being like, this is bananas. Like, 2 weeks ago I was like in the middle of nowhere, like no electricity, no water, and look at this, like this is crazy.
Uh-huh.
But I was also like 18 and thought it was just class crack.
Yeah,
you know.
Did you do that thing whenever kids go to uni at 18, they think, here's a great opportunity for me to reinvent myself. And then they're like, right, I'm going to start dressing like this or talking like, this is the new me. You know, I've moved from Korean to Belfast. Hopefully I don't bump anybody from Korean. They'll see me like with a gold medallion.
Purple mohawk.
Yeah. But was that your experience? Was Rwanda kind of reinventing yourself or maybe discovering something or just exposing yourself to like a new experience or new way of life? And then bringing that to New York then, you know, bringing your dumb phone, bringing journaling, was that something that was new to you at the time?
Rwanda really, really kick-started me journaling. Like, I always journaled, like, I had notebooks upon notebooks. But, I mean, like, Rwanda's whenever I really got serious about writing,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting too. Mm-hmm. Never thought of that. Good spot, Trimble, you're good at this.
Yeah.
I think the whole experience of going to Rwanda, it felt less like reinventing myself and more like, oh, it's so wanky to say this, more like, careful, having the freedom to be who you really are.
That's an interesting theme. Let's come back to that.
Yes,
because
it's going to tie into the Northern Irish stuff later.
I think so. Yes,
it will.
I think so.
Totally. We're tracking.
Yeah,
totally,
massively. And I'm racking my brain. There's something you said earlier on that again ties into that as well. But, have you had more on the New York stuff before we move on? Before we move on to the gardening and the delivery.
Okay, maybe this would be helpful. So I got out of the nonprofit social service sector because I just couldn't stop burning myself out. So I actually realized, and I'm not necessarily boxing myself in like this forever, but I actually, while I am good for that whole social service nonprofit sort of role,
mm-hmm.
it is not good for me.
Okay.
And my kind of obsessive all-in nature
mm-hmm.
is fine when you're making t-shirts. Well, actually, it was barely fine when I was making t-shirts. You know what I mean? Yeah. It was volatile. Anything I get obsessed over is a bit volatile. So whenever it is something as intense as working with addicts and working with people who are about to be evicted because mm-hmm. of their chronic hoarding problem. A lot of the work we did was with hoarders, which is super niche, but super, super great. Super great. And there's just, New York was really tough. Like, we carried a lot of responsibility.
It was life or death, though. I mean, addicts and gang members, it's serious issues. So it makes sense that it was all-encompassing.
Yeah, and we had, you know, there were some wild things happen. Like, I had a friend get shot and we lost him. And it was really, you know, there was lots of difficulties wrapped up in that. Lots of beauty wrapped up in that. So where I met my wife, it's like, I wouldn't be married if I didn't go to New York. Mm-hmm. You know, so I look back at Matthew in Rwanda, who didn't want to go. It's like, no, bro, go. Mm. Like, she's waiting for you. Go, 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 go. So it was all good, but I learned a lot about myself, and I learned that I think because of my sensitivity, I need to be careful about what I expose myself to and how long, because I carry things very heavily.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned over the last 3 years, like with ups and downs, that I can still help people, but I can do it in a way that it doesn't wreck me. Because I realize, like, New York, like, at the end of New York, like, I was so done. Like, I don't think I could have done another year. Like, I think if I had done another year, I actually would have burnt out, like, clinically burnt out. And so it was a great life lesson because, oh, well, now I know that I can't be a full-time social worker.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, like, not to disrespect the education system, but I went and I did it for 3 years and I experienced it and I experienced life and I learned a ton of lessons versus going to university for 3 years and boxing myself into, or feeling like I'd boxed myself into a career that I couldn't walk away from.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really glad that I actually learned at a young age, this isn't for me in this capacity, maybe in a different way. But that actually freed me up and allowed me to pursue other things in my life. And I mean, not like the things that we learned over there was just mental as well, like an invaluable life experience.
Were you prepared? Were you trained for encountering those sorts of people and those sorts of situations, and as you're saying, life and death stuff. Because you said yourself, you carried a lot of it with you. You know, a lot of people, mindfulness is very trendy nowadays. Mm. You know, to kind of be aware, to kind of pinpoint, this is why I'm feeling like this, to almost identify feelings or thoughts or, you know, heavy burdens that maybe you experienced.
Yeah.
Were you ready for that, or should there be a more thorough training? Like, it does sound a little bit like you went from Rwanda and just started working with people with no exposure. What was it?
So, I mean, like, all that sort of work, like, no matter who you work with, it's always going to be boots on the ground, learn as you go. Like, nonprofit sectors are stretched to, like, every last bit of tension as possible. You know, you really rely on people like that coming in and just jumping in and just learning as you go. I think, like, that's not really what plays a role in this. I think actually what played the role was I only discovered I was an introvert whenever I moved to New York. Mm-hmm. That sounds bizarre, but like if you would see me, like, and I even if I was young, like, I would speak on stage, like, I would, like, preach at my church, and I would, like, you know, I would be life and soul, and I would, like, go up to random people and talk to them. So I classic, like, very extroverted traits, but actually I'm like a fake extrovert. I'm like an extrovert in an introvert's body. And so I realized, especially by having roommates, like living with those guys who I absolutely love to pieces, I seriously needed my own space. I needed time to recharge. And I actually was a very sensitive, introverted wee soul. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know that, because my whole life, I think because of my confidence, I had always been shoehorned into kind of like, oh yeah, he's an extrovert, he's a leader, like, oh, he'd be a good CEO someday. I would be a terrible CEO. And I know that now. Like, I'm a great independent worker. See, managing people or delegating stuff to people, that is like, that does not come, that's not naturally in my skill set, but because I'm confident I can speak, people just assume, oh yeah, he's a natural born leader, like, da 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 da. But New York really taught me, actually, no, you're not. And I thought I was a bit like superhuman, like, I thought I could go and I could deal with all this craziness and, like, be on the street and, like, you know, no sweat to me, like, I'm just like a man of the people, like, blah blah blah. And actually I got owned. Like, I really did. And it was good for me to learn that. And like I said, it's good for me to learn that at a young age. So it was less about the training, and more, it was more so I was given a lot of freedom, which I'm grateful for. But a lot of my own pain came from, like, personal mismanagement rather than, like, professional mismanagement, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. So then off the back of that, then did you put stuff in place to kind of, as you say, manage yourself better, or be aware that you need more time to yourself, or... Maybe the journaling was a part of that. What practical steps did you put in place to not get to that point where you were carrying things, heavy burdens of people?
Like, the honest answer is just to do less.
Yeah.
Be that's disciplined. That's not always the answer for people.
Mm-hmm.
But really it was, how do I cut and how do I focus? The other thing was, like, I learned a lot of habits that really I have learned are, like, essential for me. And it's like, it's nothing like revolutionary. It's like, wake up with an alarm early and write a wee bit and spend 15 minutes in silence and drink water and go to bed at a reasonable hour, like, all the basic sort of stuff. But I remember reading a book when I was like 14 called Margin. It's a class book. It was written ages ago, and it kind of has predicted a lot of the stuff, a lot of the challenges we're facing today because of technology and things like that. But he has this thing where we all need a margin in our life, because the margin is like the reserve in the tank that allows us to deal with the emergency situations. But the problem is, most of us now, in like the very hyper-connected, busy age, we have no margin. And so whenever something extreme does happen, we're sent completely over the edge. And I would say, like, still to this day, one of my biggest challenges and one of the things I focus most of my inner energy on is trying to maintain that margin. Because when that margin goes, for me especially, not even especially, but I think for anybody, like, it's just a bad place for me. So there's lots of things, and we could talk for like 2 hours about what I do to maintain that margin, but the principle applies to anyone and whatever way they work. It's just, what do you need to do to keep that margin? And I would say I need a larger margin than other people. And I fought against that for so long because I was like, no, you are CEO or you are a whatever. Uh-huh. And actually I've learned to be more realistic with myself and say, actually, there are people who can operate with a much lower margin in life, but you're not one of those people.
Yeah.
And I just had to accept that.
Yeah. It's probably the sensitivities and, you know,
it's the sensitivity.
It's that stuff. Yeah. Right. That's enough about New York. Let's get ourselves back to Belfast.
Boom.
Back to the best of Belfast. So when you were in New York, did you have the idea about starting Best of Belfast? Or I know it didn't look exactly like a podcast at that stage. Yeah?
No, not at all. So when I was in New York, something that I was looking forward to, something I was always striving to do was have, because I am a creative, like that's something else I learned as well. Like I need to have some form of creative expression. And so I started a couple of stuff when I was over there. Like I had like a small newsletter where I like shared stories about what happened in New York. And I really, really enjoyed that. And it was like such an outlet for me. And so
you just send it to a bunch of friends back home?
Yeah, pretty much. It was like a small group of people, like 50 to 70 people maybe. And just really, really, like I was like, this is good. I like this.
Yeah.
And then when I was leaving New York, something that I was really excited about leaving New York was to pursue like side hustles and just wee projects and just things that I didn't have the capacity to do when I was over there. Because we would work like at least 60 hour weeks and it was, you know, really full on. We were off like 1 day a week. So your 1 day a week kind of ended up being, well, this is when I do the work that's not work. You know, I do my laundry. I go to the laundromat and, like, you know, you do your shopping and all that sort of stuff. So I just felt like I didn't have any space time-wise, but also just, like, energy-wise. I felt like I didn't have anything to give. So I was looking forward to moving back home to intentionally give myself a serious amount of space to pursue, like, all those kind of wee creative endeavors.
Yeah, and then you got married as well.
Got married, yeah. So
was that a side hustle?
It still is a side hustle. It's the, you know, we're living the dream. Married Jackie in August. So we moved, I think we just came back for the wedding. And then we were really fortunate. We had like 3 weeks, or maybe even, we had like a month off of like honeymoon. And then we settled into a wee house in Belfast.
Mm-hmm.
And
you built up your margin again in that month.
I totally, actually, to be honest, like that first, like those 6 months, it was all just refilling the margin,
just margin building.
It was margin building, bro.
24/7 margin building.
24/7.
That should have been the podcast name.
Yeah,
24/7 margin building.
Because the garden work and the delivery work mm-hmm. was total margin building.
Mm.
That sounds so weird. Margin building.
Yeah,
it was mindless work. Like it was physical work. It was Rwanda work. Oh, my word. I never realized that.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just being outside, working with your body, being out in all of the weather and all of its glory, and a wee bit of like connecting with people, like going and having a cup of tea and a biscuit with the old lady of the house you were scarifying, or, you know, having a crack with the restaurant owner in Deliveroo.
Yeah.
It was great.
Did you journal that time?
Yeah, I did.
So that's is that still in the vault? Like, is
the
that
archives?
Yeah,
I actually,
has that made its way out yet?
I actually wrote one of my first weeks actually after we got married. I just like, and this is, I hate this cliche, like kind of like creative artsy story, because it's the exception to the rule, but. I did, like, I came home and, like, after working in Deliveroo for, like, a couple of months, I wrote a novel, and I wrote a novel in, like, a week. And it was, like, all about, surprise, surprise, a Deliveroo rider in Belfast. And it's actually something that I'm still working on. And a lot of the things that I've done since moving back have been to kind of prepare for that novel and improve my own writing skills so I can bring that up to a standard that I'm happy with.
Yeah. You wrote it in a week?
Yeah. It was like, this is why I hate sharing the story, because it's like you hear these stories and it never happens like this. Like, where, like, I literally sat down and probably wrote like 8 hours a day and the words just flew off the page.
Wow.
Like, it was bananas.
Mm.
And I write every single day. Like, I practically write for a living. And it does not happen like that. Do you know what I mean? Like you are like some of the best, most productive writers in the world. Like, Stephen King, he's probably, people would say, he's the most prolific writer alive. He just writes like an animal. He writes 1,500 words a day. And people look at that like he's not some sort of demigod.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's for good words, that's what you're talking.
Yeah.
So, and I think that was important for me, because that kind of like reignited a lot of stuff in me where I was like, oh my word, like, I enjoy storytelling. I love writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to do it more.
So did you go from nothing to writing a novel in a week, or had you planned bits and pieces, or you had a few ideas for chapters, or made a few notes, or drew on some journal accounts?
I think it was, do you know what? Like, I've dived deep into the world of like bicycle currying and delivering in uh-huh. terms of like books other people have written. And it's interesting to see like some of the stuff other people have said. They've said things like riding a bicycle and writing is somehow the perfect companion, because you can kind of chew on your words as you're riding around.
Uh-huh.
And like, you know, you're thinking about an idea, you're thinking about a story, and there's something about that like forward motion and like always kind of like be moving. It just stimulates your brain. It's really, really handy.
Do you catch yourself rehearsing the story that you're going to tell?
Oh yeah.
And like redrafting it and rewording it?
Yeah. It's kind of like, it's a bit like a jigsaw puzzle, because I mean, it's different for everybody, but typically speaking, whenever I write stories, I know the start and I know the end, typically. And like, a lot of people, like, they'll scoff at that because it's boring and they want to lose themselves and they want to find out what happens next as a writer. But that's just the way it kind of happens for me. So, but I enjoy kind of like the jigsaw bit where you're like, okay, well, how do I get there?
Uh-huh.
And then you kind of think about, you don't think in chapters, but you think like, okay, then this happens. And then you kind of shock yourself. You're like, oh my word, that happened. You're like, uh-huh. How does the character recover from that? Uh-huh. Or, you know, there's an obstacle in the character's way. How on earth is he going to overcome? You know what I mean? So it is still like a surprise for you. Like,
yeah.
I was saying to Jackie recently, it's like, it's kind of like sitting down to watch a TV show, like a series. And you're like, at the end of each episode, you're like, I don't know what's going to happen next. Like, it is kind of, it's like that for you as the writer most of the time.
Uh-huh.
So it's fun.
Do you think deep down, you know the answer, but like in your, like, you haven't quite worked it out yet at a conscious kind of level? The reason why I'm saying that is I had a conversation recently with someone about dreams. And how sometimes I would have dreams and something would happen at the end, and it's like a Curb Your Enthusiasm moment, like just like right at the end, it's like it all just ties up perfectly, or it kind of tricks me, or like I fell for it, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how did I not see that coming? I wrote that.
Yeah.
I wrote this dream.
Yeah.
You know? And I was sharing this with someone recently, and after I shared it with him, he was like, oh, that's interesting. And then that night, I had the exact experience where I tricked myself.
So good.
Yeah. Is that anything similar to what you're experiencing? You kind of have a little bit of an idea where you're going?
Yeah. Like, it is a very human thing to like almost hide yourself from yourself. Something that I did do is actually, plot twist, I did go back to uni. No, not back to uni. I just went to uni for the first time. I studied creative writing. And that was very, very helpful.
Uh-huh.
But I remember like some of the most surreal moments. There was a tutor I had. Her name is Sheila. And I remember at that point, so the way it works, there's like a writer's table in the Seamus Heaney Centre, and you have to submit every single week. But at that stage, we were submitting anonymously. So like you would have like a fake name, and like you'd have a story and everyone would read your story and everyone would like tear your story to shreds. Like they would like rip into it and criticize it.
Oh, breaks your heart.
Breaks your heart. Most helpful thing ever.
Really?
But she was always freaky. I always felt like it was like going to therapy, because she would read your story and she wouldn't know who it was. And then she would literally say, do you know what? This story isn't really about X. This story is really about this deep down childhood X, Y, and Z, blah, blah, blah. And you're sitting there and you're like, oh my goodness, she's right. And you didn't even know it. But then whenever you like read the story again, you're like, that's totally what this is all about.
Yeah.
You're like, this is all about like something like deep down, like in the subconscious world. Uh-huh. And so I think the more experiences I've had like that, now I'm not great at it myself. It's hard to edit your own work, but I can get a wee bit closer. She would always say, like, where's the white hot center of the story? And so whenever I'm thinking about stories or I'm writing, it's like, well, what actually is this really all about? Like, I was writing something recently. I took like a month off to solely write something new. And I was writing away and I was like, this is great. And I was like, what is this really all about? And actually it just hit me. I was like, this is actually about my granda. That's what this is about.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I figured that out, it completely just opened up the rest of the story.
I was going to suggest that lady that you're talking about, if she was able to identify something, I would almost suggest that you be protective about that and don't draw too much attention
to
it.
You want to run away from it?
Yeah.
Totally.
It's because something here is working.
Yeah.
And if you unveil, here's the whole reason, it mm-hmm. just becomes really obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go, oh, find out it's about my granddad.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, for example, like, I'll retrofit the example onto it. So in the story that she had read, let's just say it was about... I actually remember what it was about. I don't mind telling people. It was like about a guy who had a failed restaurant business and then opened up a stand at St. George's Market. And there was like really, really, really like hidden family drama undertones.
Mm-hmm.
Like super hidden. Like it wasn't even, it was like a throwaway part of the story. And she literally just turned around and she was like, this story is about the granda. We need to bring the granda into this story in a flashback. And as soon as she said that, I was like, no, we can't do that. No. And then literally, you know, you go home and you're like, oh my word, we need to see that guy.
Yeah.
So yeah.
That's mad how something like that can kind of make mm-hmm. its way.
I actually encourage yourself, even if you could ever find the time, go to like a creative writing workshop and just do it, even if it's like 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Crescent has some. Because it's interesting to see kind of what comes out. Because once you get over the pretension and the hype of writing, like the hardest part of writing is sitting down to write.
Mm-hmm.
Once you do that, once you're actually there and you can kind of just somehow let go, it's actually really amazing what comes out.
Uh-huh. Just be careful. Don't address too many of those issues.
Yeah.
Because the reason why you're creative is because there are a few things. You know, there's a reason why all the best musicians out there have all had like addiction problems,
sure.
or like yeah. relationship. I'm not saying that's the case for you,
no,
but you
totally.
Know what I mean? There's something going on.
Big time.
They're extreme versions of it.
Yeah.
But that's why you're creative, because you can kind of draw on that sort of stuff.
Well, I would push that a step further and I'd even say creatives are sensitive. And what are they sensitive to? They're sensitive to pain. And the reason why we're attracted to, I don't know, Foy Vance's album or Bob Dylan's album is because they can communicate a sense of pain that we can identify in our own lives
mm-hmm.
that maybe we actually can't even communicate, but they've done it for us.
Uh-huh.
And it's not just pain. It could be joy. It could be, you know, happiness. It could be fear, whatever it is. But it's usually wrapped up in and around those kind of deep emotions. But yeah, you got to be careful. Like,
yeah. Do we want to be Bob Dylan? Do we want to be Foy Vance? No. But we envy the creative side of what they do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, I did like a massive thing. I think it was, I did a massive podcast interview recently about sensitivity. And like sensitivity, it's like everything. It's a blessing and a curse. Like I experience things on a heightened level than most people. I have no problem saying that. But the problem is I experience things on a more heightened level than most people.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's good and it's bad.
Yeah.
You feel the highs really more. You feel the lows more too. So it's just learning how to navigate what you've been given, and this is what I've been given. So mm-hmm.
Very good. Very great stuff. Great for me. I thoroughly enjoyed that little segment.
Yeah, you seem to be enjoying yourself. You're like, can we just talk about this the whole time?
I know. I might have hijacked it a bit because I wanted to go down that route because I found it interesting.
Yeah.
So sorry about all the other listeners.
You're the interviewer, mate. This is the perks of the job.
Yeah. So anyway, let's get back to Best of Belfast.
Oh, yeah, that thing, yeah.
whenever you came back, then that was your vision.
So it's Deliveroon.
Yes.
It's really where Best of Belfast started.
Okay.
So it's Deliveroon. I was cycling around the city and I was seeing parts of Belfast I'd never been to.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like, I mean, like, there's two sides to every story. Like the romantic marketing side is cycling down city side streets and seeing street arts and interesting cafes that I'd never seen before. But also like literally like just being honest, like driving around random neighborhoods that I'd never seen and driving between neighborhoods that had tricolors up and then like 5 minutes later, like Union Jacks up and just being in parts that I never would go to if I wasn't delivering.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, they're just where people live. So like, why would I go there? But just like really, really enjoying what I saw and having the crack with everybody. And like Northern Irish people are good banter, like as you know. But like it is like you're almost like, maybe this is my own weird head. I'm my own world. But like you're like delivering around the city. You almost kind of feel like you're a character in the city. Because like everyone's like you're cycling down like the Lagan and like the group of like 14-year-olds go past and they're like, yeah, upper-ray! Or like you're sitting like beside the bus stop and the wee old lady's talking to you. Like for some reason, the uniform gives people permission to interact with you.
Uh-huh.
Like the same way you would, I don't know, it's interesting. So again, this is probably like where a lot of the podcast stuff came from. I would just talk to people all day. Like I would literally sit in Corn Market sometimes and people would just come up to you and just talk.
Uh-huh.
And you're like, this is amazing. Or you're waiting for Bujan to like make the order and you're just chatting to the guy who works behind the counter or you're talking to the other Deliveroo guys. See, honestly, like one of the reasons why I wrote that book and why I'm keen to get that Deliveroo book out there is because see the stories of some of the writers. Like you cannot believe it. Mm. Like in the same way, like the people who buy Harry Potter t-shirts are a certain type of person.
Uh-huh.
The people who work for Deliveroo is a certain, it takes a certain kind of person who says, I'm going to make a living by getting on a bicycle.
Yeah.
Like the stories are unbelievable. And yeah. So just being exposed to that and legitimately like seeing Belfast and coming from that New York experience and like, you know, Brooklyn and like cutting edge of culture and then come back to Belfast and being like, actually, legitimately, like you couldn't get better in Brooklyn. Do you know what I mean? Like,
uh-huh.
They're like seeing parts of the city and going to places like this is just like there, only it's Northern Irish. And I think it's better because everyone knows each other.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's better because it feels more like a community than it does just like this really kind of icy sort of environment.
Yes.
And so that was why I started Best of Belfast.
To showcase like, those, to showcase the stories.
100%. And because I had that salvation moment of coming back to Belfast and falling in love with it after hating it. Really simply, I was like, I just want to somehow help other people have that same experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought about, why did I hate Northern Ireland when I was growing up? Well, I hated it because I didn't know about the good things that was going on here. So actually, it was a bit of a marketing problem. So I think the reason why people don't like Northern Ireland is a marketing problem. So if I'm going to solve it, it's going to take some form of marketing. And I'm using marketing really loosely as like the spreading of ideas.
Uh-huh.
And so I just like, let's start this thing that spreads good ideas about Northern Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Let's try to change the negative narrative.
Fundamentally, the concept is challenging because,
yeah.
and we touched on this earlier on, but people from Northern Ireland do not, ever, we never talk about how good we are at things.
Yeah,
we never get carried away. We never put our head above the parapet because we're going to get shot down.
Yeah,
but you know, preemptively we might shoot ourselves down
totally
because we know we're going to get shot down by someone else.
Yeah,
because we like to keep each other humble.
Yeah,
there's something really genuine and sincere and nice about that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also something really, really naive about that, mm-hmm. and something we actually hold ourselves back
totally.
I take it this is something you've identified and this is all part of the same story.
Big time. You know what? It's tribalism. And I don't mean that in the way it's kind of used politically. It's like, mm-hmm. tribalism.
Mm-hmm.
Although it probably applies there too. But, you know, if you look at a tribe, like the kind of like the number one goal of the tribe is safety, security, self-preservation. And if you want to stay safe, it makes sense. Don't be noticed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't put yourself out there.
You won't win, but you definitely won't lose.
Exactly. And then you compound that small island feel that Ireland and Northern Ireland have. Tight-knit communities. Everybody knows everybody. It sets you up in such a way that, you're scundered to come out and be a ballerina. Because, you know, everybody in Northern Ireland is going to know about it. That's what it feels like.
Yeah.
You know, all my mates from school are going to know that I like to dance, but all I want to do is dance. Do you know what I mean? So the, like, interconnectedness of it all, like, is kind of scary and kind of off-putting. But then I think you compound that with the troubles, where actually people don't want to be noticed. You want to be invisible. Like, you just want to, like, keep your head down and don't cause any trouble. Mm-hmm. And actually, I don't want anyone to know my family. I don't want anyone to know where my family lives, because mm-hmm. I'm scared. I am, like, I'm fearful for my own safety. I think it kind of had, like, this multiplying effect on that small island mentality. Mm-hmm. And what's really interesting about Rwanda is Rwanda had the genocide in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And Rwanda, that story was the story about two communities set up against each other,
mm-hmm.
the Hutus and the Tutsis. And so it's like there was a lot of parallels between Rwanda and Northern Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like when that was going on, it was like neighbor on neighbor, the same way the Troubles was.
Uh-huh.
And you just see that interconnectedness, it makes it, even the American Civil War, like any time where it's like neighbor against neighbor, it's just really, really tricky. And it creates this vacuum where nobody wants to step out of, nobody wants to be noticed. And so fast forward, like, I'm a child of the Good Friday Agreement. I've grown up in peace and I'm really, really chuffed that I was able to. But now, as we're trying to move forward and as we're trying to, you know, how do we adapt our culture now in a place of peace? How do we build the economy? How do we give opportunities to young people? As that's becoming more and more entrepreneurial and it's less and less safe, like you were saying, there's less jobs. There's less of people like us do things like this. There's less of the status quo is being changed. There's like this tension between the island mentality and actually the global mentality. And that is where most Northern Irish people, I think, find themselves. You know, especially younger people, you have parents and grandparents who are trying to hold them back from going in this new direction.
Mm-hmm.
And there's parts of this new direction that maybe they should be held back from. I'm not saying progress is always amazing or always good,
mm-hmm.
but I think people then feel totally torn, and it's easy for them to shut down parts of themselves then, because they're like, well, actually, I do want to be a ballerina, you know, or I do want to start a t-shirt company, or I do want X, Y, and Z, but I'm afraid of what my core community will say about it. Other places you may face haters, quote unquote, from like the outside world, but weirdly enough, like, our haters are on the inside because they care about us. They don't want to see us be publicly humiliated. They don't want us to be laughed at. They don't want us to fail. They don't want us to have a failed t-shirt business and have to go and get a job in the civil service or whatever it is. So it actually comes from a place of love, and that's something that I've come to terms with a bit more recently. I used to be a bit more radical and hard on that.
Yeah.
But actually, it comes from a good place. So part of the thing we need to do now as well is, and I don't know why I'm thinking about Young Enterprise, part of their, and this is not official, by the way, this is Matthew Thompson, not the organization speaking, it's almost like, how do you convince, not the kids, the kids get it. Well, a lot of them get it.
Uh-huh.
But it's how do you encourage their parents to trust them enough to go and do it?
Yeah.
So if you think about like trying to change that culture, it's easy enough to get the young people on board. And when I say young, I'm like under 40.
Uh-huh.
It's harder to get them to actually do it because they have that
baggage.
Yeah.
An influence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then also it's kind of become culturally cool to hate Northern Ireland.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
But like, I think what we touched on earlier on, kids grow up here and they go to uni and massive brain drain. Obviously, loads of people go to uni across the water. And then it's that rediscovery, or maybe they feel like maybe this is a more appropriate place where I can be a ballerina, a ballet dancer. What was it?
Yeah, we'll go with it.
I suppose it doesn't matter. But I can, you know, I can do something that's a little bit less, you know, less jobby,
yeah,
or less typical or less kind of expected.
Mm-hmm.
And then they maybe look back at the way their upbringing and the influences they had when they were in Northern Ireland, and maybe just think, you know, that we're in the dark ages,
yeah,
when we're not, because they are a reflection of that. They just as you say, the influences in their lives, grandparents and parents, just need to be educated a little bit, or maybe just encouraged, or just maybe just let go a little bit. And I find this interesting because, you know, I've got three kids now, and
Do you have three? I didn't know you had three. I thought you had two.
Yeah, but like, I think it's three. But I would love to encourage, you know, like a little bit of a free spirit in them and a bit of creativity, and just, you know, if that's what you're good at and that's what you're passionate about, go for it. But I know as a dad, I will be slightly more inclined, if anybody else who I was given advice to, or anybody else who for some reason wanted my opinion, I would say, go for it. That is brilliant. Yeah, that's inspirational. Yeah. That's class.
Yeah.
We just did on the podcast, slight tangent, on the podcast yesterday, spoke to a guy called Ian McKinley, a guy who went blind in one eye.
Oof.
Playing rugby in Ireland, and for some reason the glasses he was using, the protective glasses, obviously then your one functional eye becomes unbelievably valuable to you.
Goodness,
so
yeah.
There was a protective glasses that he was using when he was playing, but you weren't allowed to use them in Ireland playing rugby for some stupid law that they had, right? He moved to Italy, started playing club rugby in Italy, got a gig with Treviso, Benetton Treviso. Now he's an Italian international. Inspirational story.
Madness.
Inspirational story, right? So if Ian McKinley had said to me years ago, do you think I should move to Italy? I would have gone, class, brilliant, go for it, that's amazing. But if my son or daughter say to me, here, should I go to Italy? I go, no, I'll miss you. Mm-hmm. I want you just to grow up here. I want you to live nearby. Mm-hmm. I know that my influence on them will be a lot more conservative than it could be someone else.
Yeah.
So it's not fair for us to be critical of parents, you know, and it's early days for me as a dad, but I can see that
on
down the line.
The interesting part of all that is though, that it has to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is, I think I'm not an economist, so what the heck, like why do I even say this? But the way things are changing, I don't think we have a choice, as in like the job I think is dying.
Uh-huh.
I think it will die. It won't go extinct. There will always be jobs.
Yeah.
But the amount of them, the value of them, and the security of them,
mm-hmm,
is quickly eroding before our eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And I...
Here especially.
Yeah.
Because we've always got more funding than the rest of the UK would have got. We have to find a way to kind of boost that private sector.
Yeah. And I definitely, like, I'm a part of the gig economy. Like, I have, I don't know, three or four streams of income. I think that will be the norm for most people in, you know, the foreseeable future. The interesting part of that is this will help you as a dad. Carol from Young Enterprise, I remember I was worried about my financial situation like 2 years ago. I was like, because, you know, I just got married. We're thinking about starting a family. I was like, you know, is this okay? Like, do I have permission to do this? It's funny. We always like try to get permission. And she was like, look, here's the way to think about it. If you have a job and you lose that job, you're screwed. If you are an entrepreneur or whatever, and you have four, five streams of income, you have four or five clients, and you lose a client, no big deal, because you've got these other ones supporting you as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's actually a real security in being self-employed and entrepreneurship that is overlooked because of how difficult it is. But I know for a fact now, if all of my ventures and endeavors go belly up, I'm very employable. And I'm very employable because of the skills that I've learned by going down this entrepreneurial sort of road.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the other big, massive moment for me. I swear, I actually sat one night with my wife and I cried because she turned around. I was freaking out about business and I was freaking out about everything. And she literally said to me, it's like, Matthew, you do realize you could get a job? I was like, what? Are you serious? Like, I
get out of here.
Yeah,
Johnny.
I was like, I just built up in my head that it was this way or the highway. Like, it was like, be an entrepreneur or bust. Like, that's what I had in my head. It says a lot about my kind of like compulsiveness, I suppose. But that moment, like, I swear, those were some of, like, the most, that was one of the most liberating moments of my life. It's like, oh my word, like, I could get a job. Do you know what I mean? So you always have that to fall back on. Or for young people who are like 18, I always encourage people, like, go away. Like, uni will wait for you.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, whenever you come into uni, you'll be far more equipped for uni. You'll get more out of uni.
Agreed.
Whenever
completely.
You come back.
So whenever I studied theology in my undergrad, to be fair, it took me a long time because I was doing it while I was playing rugby. But
side hustle.
My mindset when I was doing my undergrad was ridiculously different than my mindset when I was doing my postgrad, because it was like I had a lot more stuff on. I had kids at the time. I was playing rugby full time and I was studying in the evenings. So everything was going against me. But when you're more mature and you've got more life experience and you realize you can't kind of value the opportunities more,
mm-hmm.
I got infinitely more out of it.
Totally.
So I would agree completely with
you. Yeah. And the other thing is, like, I'm not going down this rabbit hole, but you know, uni, I think, doesn't really equip people for the real world, because the real world is becoming more and more bootstrappy and entrepreneurial, mm-hmm. but the system is training you for a job. But that's all I'll say.
Yeah. I don't think we should completely knock jobs either. There's a lot of very admirable jobs out there.
Absolutely. I love how this thing's
totally
sticking.
Like, belittling jobs by calling them jobs.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Oh, what? You have a real job?
Yeah.
Loser.
Well, with, I don't want to date this podcast too quickly, but with coronavirus, there's a big part of me wishes I did have a job.
But then at the same time, I've plenty of mates currently who've lost their jobs.
Like, can we stop calling them jobs?
But you know, like, I have people who work in hospitality. Uh-huh. And they're on stat pay. They're on £90 a week,
mm-hmm.
because they've lost their job. And so, I mean, the security of traditional employment, I think, is overhyped.
Yeah.
Because I think, like, obviously entrepreneurs fail all the time. But whenever they do fail, like, it's broadcasted by the tribe.
Yes.
Look at this individual who stepped out away from the way things are done.
Uh-huh.
This is, it's a cautionary tale. Oh, look what happened to such and such. See, that's why you need to go and get a job.
Thought he was special.
Exactly.
Thought he could do it by himself.
Who does he think he is? His mommy told him he needs to go and study English literature, and look what happened to him.
Grant, listen, we're running out of time, and the thing I want to talk about just before we finish is you removing yourself from social media and getting a dumb phone. And I find that so interesting, and I can 100% understand why you've done it. I just can't understand how you could do it.
Mm.
How I just can't see how I could do that.
Yeah,
I've tried it for little periods of my life. You know, remove Twitter, Instagram, yeah. Facebook, all that. And that's grand.
Yeah,
it's just the Google Maps and the WhatsApps, and there's always going to be something for someone
sure.
else. There'll be something else.
Yeah,
talk us through that process.
Yeah, so. I mean, the overarching theme of leaving social media is this kind of idea of going deep instead of going wide. So I realized, like, because the podcast, well, it wasn't even a podcast then, Best of Belfast, was big online. And it had, you know, a big following or whatever. But it was having, like, a really small impact on loads and loads of people. Like, people would, like, swipe on their lunch break and be like, oh, that's a cute photo of City Hall, and then that would be it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of hit me. I was like, well, I kind of want to do more than that, but I don't have the time or the energy to do everything. That's what I'm talking about, doing less. So the commitment really was, well, what really makes a difference in people's lives? And I'm not talking about, like, I'm changing, you know, I'm saving the world, but, like, a podcast has much more a likelihood to move somebody than a photo on Instagram does, because, like you said, the intimacy,
mm-hmm.
there's depth to it, there's a length to it even that is significant. And so really simply I said, look, because I was spending probably like 30 hours a week online, because I had like a social media business, I was like running like different businesses, accounts and everything. And I was like, look, if I took myself off social media, I would get 30 hours a week. And I just asked myself the question, if I were to do that, what could I do with those 30 hours? And when I sat down and I thought about it from a personal perspective and a professional perspective, it really seemed like a no-brainer. And so I just did it. And there are definitely challenges that you face, like 100% having the dumb phone, like silly challenges, like you said, Google Maps, what do you do?
Uh-huh.
But for me, the challenges you face having a smartphone are far more significant than the challenges you face not having a smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
So practically speaking, I have a Chromebook. I have like a wee laptop at home and I have WhatsApp on it.
Uh-huh.
And so I can sign in like, you know, a couple of times a week or whatever and do all my group chats.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean? And I can sort out when I'm meeting the lads next, and I can sort out when such and such is coming over for tea, and I can ping something into my family group like, okay, yeah, do you want to come over on Sunday? Yeah, no sweat. So I can do all of that and get all the value out of WhatsApp
uh-huh.
without having WhatsApp like ping me every second.
Uh-huh.
And the type of person I am, you know, I could turn off all my notifications. Oh, baby, I'm still checking that bad boy.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like I just... And I realized I was spending unnecessary amounts of willpower on things that I didn't have to spend it on.
Uh-huh. Would you have considered meeting halfway and like deleting WhatsApp, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all that from your phone, but then you've still got your car parking app, your Google Maps, your stuff that's genuinely going to save you time?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I've experimented with loads of stuff like... you know, I then got a smartphone and I deleted everything off it, you know, and kind of kept certain things. I don't know, man. I just find that whatever I kept on it, like I even took Safari and stuff off it, I just found that I was still always going to it.
Uh-huh.
Like, I can't explain it. I don't know. Like,
I get it.
Apple witchcraft, because like even if it was like pointless stuff, like I'd find myself like literally scrolling through Spotify. You're like, what am I doing? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't know. There was just something about it. Maybe it was just like I didn't leave enough time of a pattern to be interrupted. But I just found that I would just always be on it. So again, it's like the amount of time I would spend on a smartphone, I would make it like three times it back by not having it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's like, it's clunkier in some areas, but for me, like from a purely numbers point of view, I like make it up and more in other ways.
Yeah.
Purely from time, not to mention the like mental space and like the freedom and the quiet and the creativity and the whatever, you know.
Yeah.
I think like a lot of people overestimate the role social media plays. But I think it's also because currently in our culture overestimates social media.
Mm-hmm.
Like people, and I suppose like working with social media and having a large account helped me see this. Like people assume if you have like 100,000 followers on Twitter that like there's nothing in life you cannot do. You know, like people are like, if I just had this, then, oh man, everything else would be easier. And then you probably have experienced this like with starting your business. It doesn't matter how many followers you have, like you put stuff out there and it's still a slog to make it happen.
Yeah. Like, as you say,
unbelievably.
People just scroll on past.
People do not care.
Yeah.
Like people care about what they care about.
Uh-huh.
And so like your job as an entrepreneur or a marketer or a creative is to make people care. One of the reasons you make people care, or one of the ways you make people care, is by enabling them. So like being an assistant to them on the journey that they want to go on.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, to land, like to put that in your perspective for like for what you do, not every sports team in the world is going to sign up and use Kairos, but there are sports teams out there that exist that are like, oh, they're frustrated. There's pain. I am angry at how inefficient this process is.
Mm-hmm.
So those people there, that's an easy sell because they're like, hallelujah, finally someone's done this. Mm-hmm. Or in my context, like the person who legitimately hates Northern Ireland is not going to listen to Best of Belfast and all of a sudden love it.
Uh-huh.
It's the people who are like, do you know what? I think Northern Ireland's all right, you know? Like, I think it's decent. Like, it's actually okay.
They're low-hanging fruit.
Yeah. Sorry for the low-hanging fruit listening. But, you know, it's those are the people that I'm interested in. because I can actually give them tools and content and proof. You're right. Northern Ireland is cool. Here's 100 episodes to prove it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Or, yeah, you're right, actually. Like, there are some unique cultural hang-ups we have in Northern Ireland. Here's someone who also thinks the same and who's going to talk about it. And let's talk about how we can find solutions to those problems.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know, the day I think will come where there is kind of like a big social media fallout. Definitely, if you want to be really smart about it, and this is just the truth, you can leverage all the value from social media and WhatsApp and everything in like 2 hours a week. You could check it once on a Tuesday and once on a Friday, and you could schedule your posts, and you would get all of the value from it and mm-hmm. none of the drama mm-hmm. or none of the personal hang-ups. For me, the two reasons why I didn't do that is because, like I said, I find it very difficult to stay away. It's easier for me to have a hard cut and almost burn my bridges, because otherwise I would just find ways to jump over the river, if you know what I mean.
Uh-huh.
Mixing metaphors here. And then the other reason is because, and I have no problem saying this, I wanted it to be a statement. Yes. Like, there's a reason why this dumb phone is obnoxiously big.
Uh-huh.
Like, there are sexier dumb phones out there than this uh-huh. old builder's yes. cat phone.
Yeah.
But, like, I'll be honest, like, I look around at, like, a lot of the problems we're facing today in Northern Ireland and beyond. I look at a lot of the mental health stuff going on. I look a lot at just, like, the margin-destroying stuff that's going on. And a lot of it stems from the phone. And I just wanted to show people that you have the option. You have the choice. Like, you don't have to use smartphone. You don't have to use social media. You don't have to do these things. Like, they're not obligations. You actually can choose not to. And so by me hanging out on more of the extreme end, and I completely accept that it's extreme and not everyone should or would do it. But hopefully I can at least give people the chance to think for themselves, oh, maybe I actually am going to have a separate phone for my work, or maybe actually I'm going to leave my phone in the office whenever I go home, or maybe, you know what I mean? Like, uh-huh. to take smaller steps, they're going to be better for them. Yeah. Plus for me, I love it. I absolutely love having a dumb uh-huh. phone. Like, honestly, like, the freedom, the time, the clarity, and now I have a new phrase, thanks to you and this chat. It's like Rwanda.
Uh-huh.
This is my little piece of Rwanda
uh-huh.
that I can have a bit of Rwanda in my Western life, and it's good for me. I like it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure most people who listen to your explanation would agree with all of it, but maybe just not that many people have the conviction to go cold turkey.
Mm.
So fair play to you, and it's given you a story to tell, and it's as you say, you're an example that it's possible.
Mm.
To remove a lot of distractions and kind of remove a lot of clutter from our lives.
Yeah, and the thing is as well, like, I'm interested in, and legitimately, like, if you've made it all the way through to this, towards the end of this interview.
Is, like, this the longest one you've ever done?
No. Really?
It's the longest one I've ever done. I'm in charge. It's my fault.
I'm interested in connecting with and adding value to, like, the people who listen to the podcast on a regular basis. Like, there's people who dip in and dip out. That's awesome. That's cool. Like, please listen. But, like, it's the people who are really on board with what the podcast is doing and what we're trying to do. Like, those are the people that I'm interested in connecting with. So all of my, like, social media time and energy, I want to divert towards, like, those people. I want to divert towards the podcast instead of, like, somewhere else, because as you described it, the low-hanging fruit, like, the people who do love Northern Ireland or who are on the fence, like, the more people like that we can encourage and we can support, I think that's how you change the culture, because those people will go up and they'll have kids, they'll deal with their colleagues, they'll interact with their families, and if I can be a point of reference to them, like, well, actually, no, I was listening to such and such, and he actually said da 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 da, or did you hear the story of this woman? She said, you know, it's just giving people even like an arsenal to go off and like and do the fight themselves. Uh-huh. And so that's where I see my cultural function of the podcast. And then the Producers Club comes into that, because these are the people who not only keep me going financially and keep the business going, but it's also, well, here is a group of people that I clearly know love Northern Ireland and are interested in pushing it forward. And my interaction with them, my conversations with them, help me do what I do better, if that makes sense. Because mm-hmm. they teach me how to serve the people who are like them. Because mm-hmm. you're not dealing with a demographic, you're dealing with a psychographic, and it's harder to pinpoint. It's not just such and such has this color of skin and they're this gender and they're this years old. It's like all over the place, but it's like trying to find, okay, well, what's the theme that runs in these people, and how do we find more people like them, and then how do we spread the movement, bro?
I hear you, Matt. This has been going on for quite a while. By the time we go out there, coronavirus might have ended the world.
Your car is going to have disintegrated.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
No, lad, thank you. I really appreciate you.
I've enjoyed this.
Taking the time out to visit the bunker.
Yeah, this is where I made this observation when I came in. This is Will Smith and I Am Legend, and just there's going to be like zombies smashing against this window.
I can be the dog, you can be Will Smith. I'll be the Alsatian.
I'll just squeeze the life from you.
That's pretty much what you've done the last hour and a half.
Thanks, Matt.
No, class mate. Cheers.
Cheers.
Deadly, bro.
Yeah.
Nailed it.
Enjoyed that.
Good crack.
All right.
Super.
How long was it right now?
An hour 40.
40.
Hi, I'm Rebecca, creative at Lines and Current, an online jewellery and accessories brand. And I live in East Belfast with my husband, John, who also works on our business with me, and our three kids. I like listening to the Best of Belfast podcast because I really love to hear the nitty gritty stuff that comes with those types of unfiltered conversations that Matt has with his local guests. I'd say my favourite episode was probably that one with Grace Chambers, the 91-year-old parkrun record holder. I think for us, we really like what Matt is doing and we've loved supporting what he's doing. He seems to just be shining a light on the Northern Irish people, community, and exposing all those untold stories. So yeah, if you've been on the fence about joining the Producers Club and you'd miss Best of Belfast if it wasn't there, I'd recommend you consider joining today. You can do so over at bestofbelfast.org, and I look forward to seeing you in the WhatsApp group soon.